Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Listen to Fresh Off the Field on your favourite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Whakawhelua ki Nissan Bolivinaka and Kupla Morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, social media ban for under 16s is now in effect in Australia. But what will this mean for our Pacific diaspora and across the region? Why is there a flotilla of Chinese naval ships moving through the region? And, well, why not end the year off with another vote of no confidence, this time against Vanuatu's Prime Minister? All those stories and more shortly. But before we get into the show, we'd like to acknowledge that the show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol, and I say Vinaka Vakalevo. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, with just 2 weeks to go to Christmas Day, many things around the Pacific, like schools, are in wind-down mode and wrapping up for the festive season. But not politics, especially in Vanuatu, where Parliament has been ordered to sit and to debate a no-confidence motion against the Prime Minister. It follows yesterday's Supreme Court ruling, which found that the Speaker of Parliament acted improperly by dismissing a notice for a no-confidence motion brought to the House by 9 opposition MPs. Opposition leader Ishmael Kalsakal welcomed the decision, which will see Parliament convene on Tuesday.
Naturally, we are pleased with the outcome and the result of the judgment of the Supreme Court. But it is, as we said, we have always been confident that the law has been settled by the Court of Appeal in respect of the factual circumstances that gave rise to this case. And this case was no different to what the Court of Appeal has said all along in the past, that once the Speaker receives the motion, he is incompetent to close the session of Parliament. And that was the decision that the Supreme Court came out with. And whilst we are pleased with the result, it could have been avoided, but we are pleased that the Supreme Court has cemented what the Court of Appeal has always held all along with regard to motions that come before Parliament and how they're disposed by Parliament.
So now that the Court has ordered for Parliament to sit next week, Tuesday, as the Leader of Opposition, do you think you have the right or enough number or members of Parliament on your side to push forward this motion against the Prime Minister next week?
Well, at the present time, it's a motion that's signed by 9 members of Parliament. We wouldn't be putting this motion if we weren't confident that we had secured the numbers. But, you know, this is politics, anything can happen. But we look forward quietly with confidence to the sitting of Parliament next Tuesday.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the reasons behind this motion against the Prime Minister? What was the motion of no confidence about against the Prime Minister?
The expressions of the motions are self-explanatory. They speak to the non-confidence that we have in the Prime Minister. Not at the present time, which I don't have a motion in front of me, but I think the first is about misdealings as a state minister, and the others relate to commissions of inquiry reports and as well as the handling of the teachers' strike.
And that there is Vanuatu's opposition leader speaking there to ABC's Lea Loenbu. We'll certainly hear more about the reasons behind the no-confidence vote when Parliament convenes on Tuesday. Again, this was almost a month after the opposition's efforts were dismissed by Parliament's Speaker. Well, as of yesterday, social media apps like TikTok, Instagram and Snapchat are no longer accessible to children under the age of 16 in Australia. Now, the new Online Safety Amendment law is now in force, protecting children from online harm, bullying, while limiting exposure to excessive screen time. But what impact will this new law have on Pacific communities here in Australia and across the wider region? To help us unpack this is Professor and Chair of Social Work and Policy Studies at the University of Sydney, Dr. Georgie Ravulovet. Welcome to the show, Georgie.
Nissan Bulavinaka and g'day. Hi, good morning.
Thank you very much. I know it is a morning and, you know, as of yesterday, I must say, how did we get to the stage where a nationwide ban is needed?
A big part of this is to ensure that we are creating and sustaining online safety for our children, young people. There has been various accounts of young people and children being exposed to material that is not helpful, whether that might be based on the content itself, but also social media has been at times a vehicle for online bullying and other areas of concern that the government is wanting to sort of look at and ensure that their young people and children are not exposed to in the future.
Yeah, and I know you've alluded to it a little bit, but why do you feel legislators felt like this was necessary?
I think legislators were of the mind that if social media companies weren't necessarily going to regulate this sort of content, it was a matter of then the government taking some sort of proactive measure. So there was also this concern of not just cyberbullying or other areas of online safety, but predatory behaviour that may occur, especially when it comes to older individuals wanting to have access to children and young people. So I think a big part was to support the development of young people and children in a happy and healthy way. So it wasn't necessarily a punitive measure from the accounts given by the government. It was more around a proactive approach to ensuring children, young people felt safe in their own communities.
Yeah, Georgie, like from your understanding, you know, under the new law, what we're seeing is that so children under 16, you know, they won't get penalised if they access those age-restricted social media platforms. It's actually the platform, right, who could incur hefty fines if they don't take reasonable steps to prevent under 16s from having accounts. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So the fines range like from tens of thousands of dollars for breach of this particular new law. And yes, it's about them putting the responsibility back on those social media companies to ensure that they're complying, again, with the idea that we are protecting children and young people from these particular harms.
Well, then, if we do look to our community here, right, like how do you think this ban will affect the Pacific community here in Australia?
So it's a mixed bag. From my point of view, social media is like any other thing that we have access to in society. For me, it's about educating people to engage with these particular resources in ways that is healthy and enables them to engage well. So for me, young Pacific people, a lot of the time they're using social media to connect to their communities, whether it be their own local communities here in Australia, let alone their communities and even their cultural communities back in the islands. So this is going to be quite an interesting, I think, journey for a lot of our Pacifica young people and children, because for them, they have utilized social media as a form of being able to connect, communicate and understand culture.
Yeah. Georgie, do you think, though, it'll be received differently, though, in, like, Pacific homes, compared to Australian families across the board?
I think it may be, because unlike maybe Australian communities that may only have family located in Australia alone, for a lot of Pacific families, children and young people, They have lots of family members in places like Aotearoa, New Zealand, but also in the Pacific Islands themselves. And for many, they've utilized social media as a way to connect, create community, and even, again, understand their own cultural perspectives and practices. So even language, the way in which we understand our Pacific languages can be part of the social media access. Mm. And so I think that might have some sort of influence over the years.
Yeah. Well, do you think this law will be, like, let's stretch it out now, right? Law would be popular with Pacific governments, you know, and do you think they might want to take this sort of approach on?
Yeah, in my experience, there has been concerns with online safety, e-safety in the Pacific Islands, especially when it comes to bullying and even areas of discrimination and abuse. There are, you know, various chat groups and pages in the Pacific that are even utilized for that particular purpose. And generally they're aimed towards adults. They're not normally aimed towards children, young people. But I think it's an opportunity for our Pacific nations to look at how do they also understand e-safety more broadly for children, young people, and the wider community.
Mm. Is there any sort of maybe countries you might be aware of that might be interested in following up with this?
I know that there's ongoing critical conversations with e-safety commissioners in places like Fiji, where they're always looking at how do they ensure that if there are concerns associated with online interactions, that they're able to actually create a response. But really, this really does involve a whole of government and whole of community response. It's not just about blaming individuals to be better when it comes to their own behaviours online. It's a matter of creating policy and legislation that is responsive. But it's not just about the creating, you know, even bans on social media. It's about being able to show that we've got broader legislation and political responses and even local community responses that stamp out things that are unhelpful. That includes domestic and family violence and other areas of concern.
I want to sort of go down, you know, there is obviously arguments from both sides, right? Critics say policy is a little bit too blunt. It could isolate vulnerable young children. I mean, how valid is this concern?
Look, for a lot of young people who may be in various equity groups, they've traditionally used social media to connect with other people so they feel like they're not alone. And so that includes people in low socioeconomic areas, but also gender and sexual diverse communities as well. They've generally utilized their platforms to create a sense of community. So yes, more broadly, there are concerns associated with such young people and how they will continue to connect and create community and access others as part of their own journey.
Yeah. I wonder if we could just quickly maybe elaborate on that, because I know, Georgie, we did a story about a month ago, you know, of Pacific kids who are here because, you know, of scholarships, and really their connection with the outside world or back to homeland is through social media. I'm just wondering how then can we sort of address that gap?
I think we're going back to pen and paper letters, and I'm just joking. I remember those.
I love those, yeah.
Well, no, this is a thing. So I think there will be opportunities for other platforms to potentially be used, whether it might be texting apps or other apps that might be introduced. But I agree. I think that we do need to be mindful that for Pacific young people that may be coming directly from the islands for a period of time, it's important they still continue to have a connection back to their communities and cultures. And so that's something that we do need to be mindful of. And I think we do need to continue to support our communities to explore different options for that to occur.
Yeah. Okay. Well, before I let you go, Georgie, again, have you been able to speak to some young children, you know, to really understand how they're feeling about this change?
I have, and they feel like they're being unfairly treated. I've spoken to a range of young people and children. Some of them are quite, you know, concerned that they now no longer will have access to material that they were previously accessing. Fun fact, I even got verified with my facial recognition app yesterday, and the app didn't recognize my face. It actually said that it was not a real face. So that's another key point. That's right. I think I do have a real face though. But I think this is the point. I think it's about navigating the technologies as well. And I think some of the young people and children have a better grasp on the technology. So I'm intrigued as to where we're going with this and whether there's going to be potential loopholes that may occur. But at the same time, this is the key thing. I think it's very, very important that Pacific parents continue to have those conversations with their children, young people, about how to access these particular apps if they are, but also the ongoing education around online e-safety and ensuring we minimise any harm.
Absolutely, yes. That conversation definitely needs to continue with our parents and our children. Look, Dr. Georgie, really appreciate you coming on this morning. Always grateful for your insights to these conversations. Thank you. That is Professor and Chair of Social Work and Policy Studies at the University of Sydney, Dr. Georgie Ravulor.
Join Natasha Metin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
When it comes to obesity prevention efforts, it's really important that it is a combination of diet, exercise, and intense counseling that comes with it.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Samoa, where the new government is embarking on a major administration-wide crackdown on illicit drugs, which includes testing for public servants. Prime Minister Lauli Alemaliatoa Politaivau Fosi says tackling the drug problem is now one of his government's top priorities. Here's Samoa reporter Adele Fruin.
The cabinet has officially approved a new directive under the PSC. Every government employee will be required to take a drug test. You will carry out your tasks and there will be a time and the opportunity to prepare for your test to confirm that you are not involved with illegal drugs.
That's Samoa's Prime Minister Lauli Maliatoa announcing drug tests for public servants during his weekly press conference.
So that the work we do is not disrupted, the main point is protection. Protection for the government in carrying out its duties, protection for you and the working environment, especially for the whole nation.
Like the rest of the community, Samoa's public service has been affected by the deluge of methamphetamines making its way into the country in recent years. And on the streets of Apia, there's support for bureaucrats to be drug tested.
I believe the government has done the right thing to pass a directive to drug test the public servants. The impact of drugs on our people is evident through violence and deaths.
That's good. It's something that needs to be done, but I believe that it should start from the top with our leaders, the members of Samoa's parliament.
The cabinet directive is part of the new administration's strategy to block imported narcotics, mostly methamphetamines, from entering Samoa. The Prime Minister says drugs are now everywhere, even schools.
I have noticed from some reports brought before me that the drugs issue has spread into schools. There are also secondary schools in the A'a'ana district extending to other schools where there was a recent commotion. The matter has now spread throughout the country.
He says the government wants to involve local mayors to come up with rules and regulations to try and tackle the problem from within villages. Drug tests are already underway in the police force. Acting Commissioner Leatawa Samuelu Afamusanga says the whole police executive has been tested.
At the moment, the policy for police drug testing has not yet been fully implemented. What is clear is that the former commissioner had started this process and we, the Samoa Police Executive, have already undergone testing.
Leatawa says that they are reviewing their policies to address the situation where an officer tests positive.
I don't know yet the full results at this time, but we are reviewing our policy, which was drafted under the former commissioner. According to the law, there is no provision about what action to take if a police officer or any person to be tested, whether the result is positive or negative. That is why we established our own policy under the instructions of the former commissioner to try and create a guideline for conducting blood tests for the welfare and integrity of police officers who come to enforce the law.
He says police have also begun their own community drug awareness campaigns.
The aim that guided the former commissioner and the ministry is that the whole nation must understand the serious problem of drugs. That is why our campaign continues, reaching villages and churches, with more than five campaigns already carried out.
Another focus of the war on drugs is Samoa's border. Prime Minister Lau Lilimalietoa says the authorities lack the necessary resources to stop the importation of illicit drugs. He's instructed relevant ministries in charge of border security to make a formal request on the equipment they need to crack down on drug imports.
And that there is Adele Fraun with that report. Pacific Beat. Residents of the Pacific's largest capital city, Port Moresby, say crippling water cuts are disrupting lives at home and at work. Authorities say aging infrastructure and water theft is to blame, with the city losing half of its water supply even before it reaches customers. And with Christmas just around the corner, residents are trying their best to adapt. But there's worries many homes will be without water in the festive season. Belinda Cora with more.
The taps are slowly running dry in PNG's capital city, while feelings of frustration are growing among the city's 430,000 residents. Constance Maso lives in what's considered a prime location in Port Moresby.
We had to use water from their standby tanks, and then that finished, and then the property owner was unable to fill it up because of the low supply that was coming from Water PNG. And then they had to opt for the water cart back to come and refill the tanks.
Even when the water is flowing, Constance says the problem doesn't end there.
But yeah, that affected the flow of things like, having to come to work and then go home and then there's no water. And then you have to wait for a scheduled time to prepare yourself or catch the water before it finishes.
Janet Mipe is a homemaker, but her home, like many others in the capital, has been without water in recent months. She's relying on her neighbors to access water. Janet had to spend money on buying containers to store water for her family.
Buckets, like containers worth of 150, 200 pina, just to put around the house for us to store our water. Even like when water comes back, we'll store our water inside the big containers. Like mine, I have a big container that I spend 150 kina to pay for that container just to put refill water and then use it to cook and wash and toilet.
Vono Libitino says it has been a challenging couple of months with poor service. She has not been able to have a proper shower and wants to know why.
We have to fill up buckets, even when it's a low, low pressure. We have to fill up buckets and have, use a pail to have a shower. And that's, I just don't like that. I'd rather have a full, refreshing shower before I start my day or at the end of the day. And I expect Water PNG, like, we're not in the village, come on. And that's really frustrating, not knowing anything, not knowing if they're carrying out rationing. So if they could provide some kind of update or notice on their Facebook page, that would be really helpful. Just that little piece of, information would be kind of, comforting to us as people that rely on their services, yeah.
John Damien lives in Baroko area and is a father of three. He says the poor water supply is affecting his whole family.
For the past 2 weeks, we've been without water, no water, none. The tap has been dry for 2 weeks. And just on Monday, we started receiving water at 8 o'clock in the morning. And then it goes off at 12 o'clock. And then it comes back on at 6 o'clock in the evening. So for 2 weeks when we were without water, I normally go to the office to refill there. So I hope that Water PNG do have an emergency response plan. I don't know if they do have one, but please, if they do have, they should deploy water cuts to all the paying residents to help help them with their water, especially for cooking and drinking and washing also.
So what is causing all these problems for Port Moresby residents? It's a question I put to Water PNG, the body responsible for supplying water to the capital. James Young is the head of Water PNG, and he took me to the Bomana Pumping Station and Mount Eriama Treatment Site, two key sites for the city's water supply, to help answer the question.
And much of the infrastructure was built in the 1960s, and actually one of the sites you saw today, the Bomana Pumping Station, was built in 1943. So you can imagine that the population of Port Moresby in those years was only a fraction of what it is today. So we're still squeezing every last drop of water out of that old infrastructure. So the challenge is one of aged infrastructure, growing population, and what goes with that aged infrastructure is often inefficiency.
The aging infrastructure is only one of the problems faced by Water PNG. Mr. Young says theft of water is another issue, compounding the city's already poor water supply.
Around about 50% of the treated water that goes into our networks is actually lost through a few factors, one of them being water theft. We have quite a high amount of sabotage of our network and water theft. Which zone? But even commercial customers sometimes have got illegal connections into our network that take quite a bit of water. And that impacts our ability to ration water. And it's why we're a little bit unpredictable sometimes when water goes off into particular zones. And I know that we certainly appreciate that the customer experience is not a good one, but also bear with us, because when we do try and ration water across the city, the amount of leakage impacts how we can operate that. There's no modern SCADA systems or automation that a modern utility might have, so it's all done manually. So staff literally run valves, turn valves off and on in a 24/7 manner.
So what's being done to fix the problem and get water supply back to normal for the city's residents? Mr. Young says an emergency repair and maintenance program is underway, thanks to a $100 million loan from the Asian Development Bank, European Investment Bank and the EU. Other administrative reforms are also taking place, including improved billing and collections. But all these will take time before residents can feel its impact. So for the time being, Port Moresby residents can expect a drier than normal Christmas this year.
And that's Belinda Cora in Port Moresby ending that report.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, the days of Fijian rugby players being cast adrift while attempting to make a career for themselves in France, sometimes with tragic consequences, could be a thing of the past now. In a historic development, the Fiji Rugby Players Association, which is only in its infancy, has already formed a second branch in Europe. With around 15% of Fijian players likely to try their luck in the Northern Hemisphere, the new branch, formed with the assistance of the French Union, will ensure those players get the right advice and guidance. Former Flying Fijians player and coach Ali Tamboa is the inaugural chair of the Fiji RPA, and his hope is that players heading to Europe in future will have a much clearer understanding of what life will be like as a professional in a foreign environment.
I guess before, you know, it was the idea of wanting to play professional, not knowing what they're getting themselves to and what's required. So they just want to come out and play. And it wasn't until they get to France, they realize, you know, some do come out on top, some challenges with the agents, the challenges with culture, and lesson learned from those that have gone there from the early stages till now. You know, they had all their shortcomings in regards to how they were looked after, how they were supported. We've had issues in the past where players have passed on. That's why we're setting up all of this. And we'll look elsewhere, because some of them are playing in Spain, some of them are in Georgia and in the UK.
How will the work of the Fiji Rugby Players Association in Europe be monitored now? Clearly, you can't be there all of the time. So, I mean, will you be relying on feedback from players, or do you have individuals in Europe who will be keeping a close eye on what happens?
We have duplicated setup that is running in Europe, mainly ex-players, and have gone through what I spoke about in regards to the challenges coming into a professional environment and the shortcomings and the understanding of it, not only in the game, but after the game, and aligning ourselves into education systems and support systems. So there is a French Fiji Rugby Players Association which then be on the ground to help and support. And there is our players in France.
So it's absolutely a case, therefore, is it, that you've talked about players who ultimately died in Europe for one reason or another. It took their own lives because of the pressure they were under. But now, anybody under mental stress, a professional rugby player from Fiji, they have somebody to turn to.
And that's what we want to educate the players going into a professional environment or going into playing overseas. There is a support system that we want to put in place. You know, I mean, this are more communal people and the different culture, the different ways, and how we could have, if there's issues off the field, if there's issues on the field, I mean, a shoulder to lean on, and those support systems that could help them enhance their time in their rugby career. You know, I mean, the rugby career is quite limited, and how best that you could maximize that earning power, not only for him, but for rugby in itself, with his family and Fiji rugby. You know, everybody benefits at the end of the day.
One person who I believe played quite an important role in establishing this branch of the Players Association is Fiji's new sports ambassador, Julian Vulakoro, who I think is based over there in France. Can you tell me about the role that he played?
I've known Julian for quite a while, ever since his playing days, and we've spoken about the challenges that we face and the development of the game in itself. And having lived there, you know, I've met him there through my coaching career when taking the team over there. And then we spoke about a lot of issues. And he was very influential in the setup and how we align ourselves there locally in France and the support from French rugby and the French league. And we know that a lot of those players, you know, go down to other levels there in France. But Julian had known and have played there, and the network and its support, it does help immensely in putting things in place as well as giving us advice moving forward.
And will he also be a key figure in the monitoring process? He will clearly want to know that what you've set up is working and that players are getting the help they need.
The association will meet regularly and at the same time have correspondence. And the next time around that we'll go visit, we have data of all the players and where they are. And that's the idea of it too. Before coming over, we've already have a data system in place, not only their game level, but their education as well as health. So any challenges and issues, we can more or less help and pinpoint where we could. And the association, our French counterparts, are there to actually monitor and assess.
And that there is Ili Tamboa, chair of the Fiji Rugby Players Association, now with a second branch in France, and he was talking to Richard Hewitt.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
When's Emily getting a show?
Well, she kind of runs this one.
She does run this
one. I don't mind being in the background, guys. I can just roll my eyes and shake my head at all the things you say. I'm happy with that.
But you know how some places have like a swear jar? We need like an eye roll slash head shake jar for Emily.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Mahalo nui loa. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoll. While Australian defence officials have been briefing their Pacific counterparts as a flotilla of Chinese naval ship moves through the region, their final destination is not known, as well as their motives for being in this part of the Pacific. But the Australian Defence Force has been keeping a close eye on them since they appeared several weeks ago. Their presence, though, has security officials in Canberra on edge and adding strain on geopolitical relations between Beijing and Canberra. So for more on this story, ABC's foreign affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts joins us. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Aggie.
Thank you for keeping us informed about this. I mean, tell us a little bit about the type of maybe naval vessels in this flotilla and, gosh, the firepower they have that's got an Australian officials so tense.
Yeah, this is a pretty formidable bunch of ships, essentially. Look, there are four vessels in the task group, to use the naval terminology. The first one is an LHD, a landing helicopter deck, which is basically a huge ship which can carry, in its case, maybe a few dozen helicopters, as well as more than 1,000 Marines. On top of that, it's got the capacity to ferry around other defence material that could be useful if you're looking to engage in an amphibious landing. Then you've also got a cruiser, which is, you know, again, a pretty formidable. It's got a pretty formidable set of capabilities, a whole range of anti-ship missiles. Land strike missiles in some instances that can travel 1,000 kilometres. You've got a frigate on top of that, which is sort of a bit like a cruiser with comparable capabilities, maybe not quite as impressive, but still quite serious. And then on top of that, you've got a re-oiling vessel. In other words, a refueler which allows this task group to basically go where it pleases, traveling, you know, thousands and thousands of kilometres without having to dock at port. So It's a pretty impressive array of ships. Mm. You know, there's been a little bit of comparison that's been done, you know, looking at the vertical launch tubes, which is where these missiles are kept, you know. And the rough estimate the most analysts make is that the entire Royal Australian Navy would only have slightly more vertical launch tubes in its entire Navy than this flotilla put together. Mm. So if you're looking at offensive capabilities, it's a pretty serious proposition.
Yeah, sounds very impressive. Stephen, is there a general understanding, though, of like what this flotilla is doing or where they're heading?
Where they're heading, no, not at this stage. So what do we know at the moment? Well, we basically know the last firm steer that we got on this was on the 2nd of December, or on the 3rd of December, when the Chief of the Defence Force in Australia gave an update from the night before. He said an Australian P-8, a surveillance plane, had flown over the task group and had spotted it about 500 nautical miles north of Palau. So that was a week or so ago, or a little bit more than a week ago. We have not yet got an update as to where it is now. So it's not clear where it is. Now, A few things seem pretty clear, though. If it had turned on its tail out of the Philippine Sea and headed back through the first island chain north of the Philippines, it's very likely we would have heard about that by now. It would have been spotted. There's an entire bunch of people that spend a lot of their time spotting Chinese task groups online and others. So it would have been reported, I think, if it had come back into that more crowded space. Similarly, there was a bit of speculation last week that it might be heading southeast directly towards Australia, and some people were wondering whether we might see a repeat of what we got in February and March this year with a task group doing a partial circumnavigation of Australia. But that's probably unlikely to have happened, because if it had come down to the waters off Australia into the Coral Sea, you know, I think the Australian government would have alerted the public by now to that. That's what happened The last time it came within Australia's, or came close to Australia's territorial waters. We got alerted by the government, and then we got daily updates basically where it was. That hasn't happened. So where does that leave us? Well, it could have headed, you know, northeast or, you know, out towards Hawaii. But analysts say that's pretty unlikely. There's just not much of benefit there. The United States will be able to watch it very closely. The signalling value of that's limited. So their assessment is that's possible, but it's unlikely. Mm. So that leaves basically only two other options. One, that it's – well, really only one other option, and that is that it's heading east at the moment. And that it's powering pretty much directly east from where it was spotted in the northern reaches of the Pacific. Now, we don't know this for sure. This is sort of an exercise in deduction, I guess, as much as anything else. But that seems the most likely explanation for where it is right now. And that means it could be located, you know, according to analysts, somewhere, perhaps around the Marshall Islands, Nauru, perhaps to the region, to the northeast of the Solomon Islands. We simply don't know, but we do know that these things traveled pretty quickly, and it could have easily have traveled roughly 5,000 k's or so since that update in early December. So it's very unlikely to still be in the Philippine Sea. It seems much more likely that it's somewhere in the northern reaches of the Pacific, but we simply don't know for sure.
Well, then, how is Australia responding to the presence of these vessels in the Pacific?
Look, very cautiously and very carefully. But the main thing that Australia's doing is they're monitoring this very, very closely, both with satellite technology, which, of course, Australia has, but also with those P-8s, with the maritime surveillance craft that can be used to basically swoop down across over them to spot their exact location. So that's the main thing Australia's doing. Unsurprisingly, there's an awful lot of effort inside government to think about what approach Australia should take if it should track into the Southwest Pacific, into countries which have great strategic importance for Australia, or if it should then continue onwards towards New Zealand and Australia. But because there seems to be a bit of uncertainty about its final destination, Australia at this point is treading pretty carefully and avoiding any public comment on exactly what it's doing. But look, the most logical explanation for what it's doing is basically it's a show of force. It's demonstrating that the Chinese Navy now has the ability to conduct these amphibious task group missions like this at a great distance, sustained with replenishment, refueling ships and supplies. It's basically signalling that it can now operate further into the Pacific with more complex naval formations. In a sense, this is not entirely new, but we are seeing a real tick up in this over the last three or four years, as a lot of those, you know, capabilities, a lot of those ships that China has poured so much time, effort and money into building, a lot of those are now coming online. So they're out of the shipyards, they've finished their initial runs closer to home, and now they're starting to spread their wings. That's probably a bad analogy for a ship, and starting to put them into use.
Well, this is the thing. You're there in Canberra, but why is there worry from there about the presence of these vessels? Like, is this level of concern appropriate?
Well, it's above my pay grade to say whether it's appropriate or not. But I think that a level of concern is absolutely understandable. Now, you know, to be clear, there's no sense whatsoever that China is going to launch any sort of attack on Australia. That's unimaginable at the moment and is not being contemplated by anyone in Australia. But nonetheless, a show of force like this, what it does is it reminds people, including in Canberra, of the capabilities that China has. And when you've got ships with these sort of formidable capabilities travelling potentially close to Australia, that's, you know, of course, assuming that they do head this way again, then that does concentrate the mind. And it concentrates the mind in ways that China might hope would change Australia behaviour. Now, what we got in the wake of that first task group in February and March was very clear messaging from official and semi-official arms of the Chinese state and Chinese state media that this was in large part about sending a message to Australia about our operations in the South China Sea. Australia, over the last few years in particular, has engaged in a whole lot of exercises in the South China Sea, including freedom of navigation, with a whole lot of different countries, including the Philippines, which has caught up in a series of disputes with China, the US, once with the United Kingdom, Canada, New Zealand, and others. And we know China doesn't like that. So one of the things that China's trying to do with exercises like the one we saw back in March, and potentially, again, we'll see what happens with this flotilla this time, is to send Australia a message. Look, you come into our backyard, we don't enjoy that, so we're going to come into your backyard and send a very clear message to you. Now, the two situations, you know, according to the Australian government, aren't really comparable, but that seems to be the message that China may be intent on sending. In terms of the Pacific, there's a separate set of messages that might potentially be sent. We're sending messages not just to Australia but to Pacific nations about China's naval power, its capability to reach places like this with enormous strike power. Now, in some ways, that's a bit contradictory to China's broader messaging about how much it values peace, etc. But, of course, it also reinforces potentially in the minds of Pacific officials and politicians about the inevitability of Chinese power. And that can have a useful shaping effect as well.
Yeah. Stephen, I do want to know, because, you know, yes, we've asked about how Australia's going to respond, how Canberra's feeling, but I'm thinking, have we actually heard from Pacific countries about this?
No, not yet, at least not as far as I've seen. But it is worth noting that because this task group's location remains not exactly top secret, but, you know, something which hasn't leaked out since its initial foray was reported, it's difficult for Pacific nations to respond, perhaps. Presumably, those Pacific nations nearby know about its location because Australia and others would have informed them. We already know that Australia has been engaging over the last few days in briefing, both in Canberra but also at post in the Pacific, letting Pacific nations know about what's going on here, giving them information, for example, about the formidable capabilities of these ships. Australia is playing its own game here. It doesn't just want to keep them informed, as it's obliged to do. It also wants to send a bit of a subtle or not so subtle message to these countries. Look, this is what militarization looks like. You know, this is what militarization of the region looks like, and what China says and what it does sometimes don't sit comfortably side by side. So, Australia's got its own interests here and its own messaging. But we haven't yet heard at all from any Pacific nations. I mean, I think we'll need to get a firmer fix on where this flotilla is before we can expect anything along those lines. It'll also be interesting if it does head further south into the Southwest Pacific, you know, around, you know, Samoa, Tonga, places like that. You know, if that does occur, will the Chinese pitch for a port visit in those nations? Or will they be satisfied to simply sail throughout these islands to demonstrate their capabilities? Again, we just don't know. We simply haven't got a clear steer exactly where this flotilla is. Until that is the case, we can't say with any, or even speculate really usefully about who might say what.
Absolutely. Stephen, thank you so much again for joining us this morning. Really appreciate you giving us some insight into this situation at the moment.
No worries. Thanks, Aggie.
That is ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts, here on Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Thank you so much for joining us here, where you can find our top stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Our team again will be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. And you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tua awhaatu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.